That night at the dinner table, he brought it out and set it down beside her plate. Doris stared at it, her hand to her mouth. "My God, what is it?" She looked up at him, bright-eyed. "Well, open it." Doris tore the ribbon and paper from the square package with her sharp nails, her bosom rising and falling. Larry stood watching her as she lifted the lid. He lit a cigarette and leaned against the wall. "A cuckoo clock," Doris cried. "A real old cuckoo clock like my mother had." She turned the clock over and over, just like my mother had when Pete was still alive. Her eyes sparkled with tears. "It's made in Germany," Larry said. After a moment, he added, "Carl got it for me wholesale. He knows some guy in the clock business. Otherwise, I wouldn't have..." He stopped. Doris made a funny little sound. "I mean, otherwise I wouldn't have been able to afford it." He scowled. "What's the matter with you? You've got your clock, haven't you? Isn't that what you want?" Doris sat holding onto the clock, her fingers pressed against the brown wood. "Well," Larry said, "what's the matter?" He watched in amazement as she leaped up and ran from the room, still clutching the clock. He shook his head. "Never satisfied. They're all that way. They never get enough." He sat down at the table and finished his meal. The cuckoo clock was not very large. It was handmade, however, and there were countless frets on it, little indentations and ornaments scored in the soft wood. Doris sat on the bed, drying her eyes and winding the clock. She set the hands by her wristwatch. Presently, she carefully moved the hands to 2:10. She carried the clock over to the dresser and propped it up. Then she sat waiting, her hands twisted together in her lap, waiting for the cuckoo to come out, for the hour to strike. As she sat, she thought about Larry and what he had said. And what she had said, too, for that matter. Not that she could be blamed for any of it. After all, she couldn't keep listening to him forever without defending herself. You had to blow your own trumpet in the world. She touched her handkerchief to her eyes suddenly. Why did he have to say that, about getting it wholesale? Why did he have to spoil it all? If he felt that way, he needn't have got it in the first place. She clenched her fists. He was so mean, so damn mean. But she was glad of the little clock sitting there ticking to itself, with its funny grilled edges in the door. Inside the door was the cuckoo, waiting to come out. Was he listening, his head cocked on one side, listening to hear the clock strike so that he would know when to come out? Did he sleep between hours? Well, she would soon see him. She could ask him. And she would show the clock to Bob. He would love it. Bob loved old things, even old stamps and buttons. He liked to go with her to the stores. Of course, it was a little awkward, but Larry had been staying at the office so much, and that helped. If only Larry didn't call up sometimes to... There was a whir. The clock shuddered, and all at once the door opened. The cuckoo came out, sliding swiftly. He paused and looked around solemnly, scrutinizing her, the room, the furniture. It was the first time he had seen her, she realized, smiling to herself in pleasure. She stood up, coming toward him shyly. "Go on," she said. "I'm waiting." The cuckoo opened its bill. He whirred and chirped quickly, rhythmically. Then, after a moment of contemplation, he retired, and the door snapped shut. She was delighted. She clapped her hands and spun in a little circle. He was marvelous, perfect. And the way he had looked around, studying her, sizing her up. He liked her, she was certain of it. And she, of course, loved him at once, completely. He was just what she had hoped would come out of the little door. Doris went to the clock. She bent over the little door, her lips close to the wood. "Do you hear me?" she whispered. "I think you're the most wonderful cuckoo in the world." She paused, embarrassed. "I hope you'll like it here." Then she went downstairs again, slowly, her head high. Larry and the cuckoo clock really never got along well from the start. Doris said it was because he didn't wind it right, and it didn't like being only half wound all the time. Larry turned the job of winding over to her. The cuckoo came out every quarter hour and ran the spring down without remorse, and someone had to be ever after it, winding it up again. Doris did her best, but she forgot a good deal of the time. Then Larry would throw his newspaper down with an elaborate, weary motion and stand up. He would go into the dining room where the clock was mounted on the wall over the fireplace. He would take the clock down, and making sure that he had his thumb over the little door, he would wind it up. "Why do you put your thumb over the door?" Doris asked once. "You're supposed to." She raised an eyebrow. "Are you sure? I wonder if it isn't that you don't want him to come out while you're standing so close." "Why not?" "Maybe you're afraid of him." Larry laughed. He put the clock back on the wall and gingerly removed his thumb. When Doris wasn't looking, he examined his thumb. There was still a trace of the nick cut out of the soft part of it. Who or what had pecked at him? One Saturday morning, when Larry was down at the office working over some important special accounts, Bob Chambers came to the front porch and rang the bell. Doris was taking a quick shower. She dried herself and slipped into her robe. When she opened the door, Bob stepped inside, grinning. "Hi," he said, looking around. "It's all right, Larry's at the office." "Fine." Bob gazed at her slim legs below the hem of the robe. "How nice you look today." She laughed. "Be careful. Maybe I shouldn't let you in after all." They looked at one another, half amused and half frightened. Presently, Bob said, "If you want, I'll..." "No, for God's sake." She caught hold of his sleeve. "Just get out of the doorway so I can close it. Mrs. Peters across the street, you know." She closed the door. "And I want to show you something," she said. "You haven't seen it." He was interested. "An antique or what?" She took his arm, leading him toward the dining room. "You'll love it, Bobby." She stopped, wide-eyed. "I hope you will. You must love it. It means so much to me. He means so much." "He?" Bob frowned. "Who is he?" Doris laughed. "You're jealous. Come on." A moment later, they stood before the clock, looking up at it. "He'll come out in a few minutes. Wait until you see him. I know you two will get along just fine." "What does Larry think of him?" "They don't like each other. Sometimes when Larry's here, he won't come out. Larry gets mad if he doesn't come out on time. He says..."
"Says what?"
Doris looked down. "He always says he's been robbed, even if he did get it wholesale." She brightened. "But I know he won't come out because he doesn't like Larry. When I'm here alone, he comes out right for me every 15 minutes, even though he really only has to come out on the hour." She gazed up at the clock. "He comes out for me because he wants to. We talk, I tell him things. Of course, I'd like to have him upstairs in my room, but it wouldn't be right." There was the sound of footsteps on the front porch. They looked at each other, horrified. Larry pushed the front door open, grunting. He set his briefcase down and took off his hat. Then he saw Bob for the first time. "Chambers, I'll be damned." His eyes narrowed. "What are you doing here?" He came into the dining room. Doris drew her robe about her helplessly, backing away. Bob began. "That is, we..." He broke off, glancing at Doris. Suddenly the clock began to whir. The cuckoo came rushing out, bursting into sound. Larry moved toward him. "Shut that din off," he said. He raised his fist toward the clock. The cuckoo snapped into silence and retreated. The door closed. "That's better." Larry studied Doris and Bob, standing mutely together. "I came over to look at the clock," Bob said. "Doris told me that it's a rare antique and that..." "Nuts, I bought it myself." Larry walked up to him. "Get out of here." He turned to Doris. "You too, and take that damn clock with you." He paused, rubbing his chin. "No, leave the clock here. It's mine. I bought it and paid for it." In the weeks that followed after Doris left, Larry and the cuckoo clock got along even worse than before. For one thing, the cuckoo stayed inside most of the time, sometimes even at 12 o'clock when he should have been busiest. And if he did come out at all, he usually spoke only once or twice, never the correct number of times. And there was a sullen, uncooperative note in his voice, a jarring sound that made Larry uneasy and a little angry. But he kept the clock wound because the house was very still and quiet, and it got on his nerves not to hear someone running around, talking and dropping things. And even the whirring of a clock sounded good to him. But he didn't like the cuckoo at all. And sometimes he spoke to him. "Listen," he said late one night to the closed little door. "I know you can hear me. I ought to give you back to the Germans, back to the Black Forest." He paced back and forth. "I wonder what they're doing now, the two of them. That young punk with his books and his antiques. A man shouldn't be interested in antiques. That's for women." He set his jaw. "Isn't that right?" The clock said nothing. Larry walked up in front of it. "Isn't that right?" he demanded. "Don't you have anything to say?" He looked at the face of the clock. It was almost 11, just a few seconds before the hour. "All right, I'll wait until 11. Then I want to hear what you have to say. You've been pretty quiet the last few weeks since she left." He grinned wryly. "Maybe you don't like it here since she's gone." He scowled. "Well, I paid for you, and you're coming out whether you like it or not. You hear me?" 11 o'clock came. Far off, at the end of town, the great tower clock boomed sleepily to itself. But the little door remained shut. Nothing moved. The minute hand passed on and the cuckoo didn't stir. He was someplace inside the clock, beyond the door, silent and remote. "All right, if that's the way you feel," Larry murmured, his lips twisting. "But it isn't fair. It's your job to come out. We all have to do things we don't like." He went unhappily into the kitchen and opened the great gleaming refrigerator. As he poured himself a drink, he thought about the clock. There was no doubt about it. The cuckoo should come out, Doris or no Doris. He had always liked her from the very start. They had got along well, the two of them. Probably he liked Bob, too. Probably he had seen enough of Bob to get to know him. They would be quite happy together, Bob and Doris and the cuckoo. Larry finished his drink. He opened the drawer at the sink and took out the hammer. He carried it carefully into the dining room. The clock was ticking gently to itself on the wall. "Look," he said, waving the hammer. "You know what I have here? You know what I'm going to do with it? I'm going to start on you first." He smiled. "Birds of a feather, that's what you are, the three of you." The room was silent. "Are you coming out, or do I have to come in and get you?" The clock whirred a little. "I hear you in there. You've got a lot of talking to do, enough for the last 3 weeks. As I figure it, you owe me." The door opened. The cuckoo came out fast, straight at him. Larry was looking down, his brow wrinkled in thought. He glanced up, and the cuckoo caught him squarely in the eye. Down he went, hammer and chair and everything, hitting the floor with a tremendous crash. For a moment, the cuckoo paused, its small body poised rigidly. Then it went back inside its house. The door snapped tight shut after it. The man lay on the floor, stretched out grotesquely, his head bent over to one side. Nothing moved or stirred. The room was completely silent, except, of course, for the ticking of the clock. "I see," Doris said, her face tight. Bob put his arm around her, steadying her. "Doctor," Bob said, "can I ask you something?" "Of course," the doctor said. "Is it very easy to break your neck falling from so low a chair? It wasn't very far to fall. I wonder if it might not have been an accident. Is there any chance it might have been suicide?" The doctor rubbed his jaw. "I never heard of anyone committing suicide that way. It was an accident, I'm positive." "I don't mean suicide," Bob murmured under his breath, looking up at the clock on the wall. "I meant something else." But no one heard him. The afternoon sun dappled the fields like droplets of honey, shining on the backs of the men as they gathered the remaining harvest in their blue-black hands. Far off, a brick structure stood like a paper cutout against the sky, its tall stacks producing a haze that hung over the landscape, the promise of a storm to come. Emma pulled her head inside the carriage, sliding her fingers beneath the rug on her lap. I'd no idea industry had come to the state. Alan Bell, her fiancé, scowled out at the passing scene, saying nothing. Emma smiled at him. It seems winter is fast on its way. He'd been sullen since they'd started this trek. The nearer they came to Bounty Falls, the less he seemed to speak. At last, her attempts to draw him out were successful. "It always arrives before one is ready," he said. Emma's gaze wandered to the window again, to miles of neat rows outside, now mostly stripped of their bounty. The silhouettes of the mountaintops were just visible on the horizon, closing in like stone gates. Emma had seen mountains before, but these seemed more imposing, participants in a conspiracy to oppress. To allay her unease, she refocused on the men in the fields. "Is it true what I read, that the freedmen have been given the vote?" Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Alan's mouth twist. It was true for certain of them. Their suffrage was repealed at the last convention. Emma sat back against the wooden bench, slipping her hands from beneath the rug to tuck a stray curl under her hat. "Do you think their suffrage will be reinstated?" "I've no gift for prognostication." Emma shrugged, accustomed to his faint churlishness. It was the only quality she disliked about him, although she never would have said so. "Surely progress will win out in the end." Alan stared hard at a spot just past her right shoulder. "Don't say so in front of my father." His tone signified the conversation was ended. Emma shrugged again and closed her eyes. When she opened them again, a half hour later, the carriage was making its way down the main road of Bounty Falls. Even in the impending darkness, Emma saw neat little storefronts of whitewashed brick, square two-story forms bearing a pleasing sameness in their sensible arrangement of windows and doors. Emma turned to Alan as the carriage bumped along the dirt track. You didn't do it justice, Mr. Bell, she said, coquettishly accusing. It's charming. Alan's stony facade shifted. It is. I can't imagine why you'd want to leave it. Alan's features underwent a curious transformation, displaying first what appeared to be a deep and seething rage, that was then replaced by a foggy expression of loss and uncertainty. I can't remember exactly why I left. His voice was like the wisp of a remembered nightmare. Youthful impetuousness, perhaps. Emma, disturbed by Alan's reaction, let the matter rest. The carriage shuddered to a halt before another brick structure, this one larger and more elegant than the others, and set apart from the town proper. Fluted columns glowed white in the dusk, framing a glass door upon which was etched Horace Bell, Clockmaker. The carriage driver helped Emma to the ground. She stood on the dirt path and looked around, enchanted, but now bothered by something she'd just noticed. Alan, where is everyone? For the streets were deserted, and even the upper windows of the shops, where people presumably lived, bore no flickering lights. Alan picked up a heavy trunk with ease, seemingly irritated by the question. They've all turned in early to be ready for the festival, I suspect. You'll see them tomorrow. Emma nodded, peering back over her shoulder, her fingers playing at the lace collar of her dress. A bell jingled in the silence, and Emma looked up to see that Alan's father, Horace Bell, had emerged from the glass door and was standing on the porch, his shadowed form barely visible. He stood there, apparently looking down at them, and for a spellbinding moment, Emma had the impression he was not a man at all, but some force of nature, a simulacrum of a human, but a spirit of far older and darker persuasion, a manifestation of the eternal, bound in a shell of skin and bone. Then he stepped down from the porch into the fading light, and he was just a man after all, though one that oddly resembled a sculpture in polished oak. Emma, dazed by the force of her bizarre delusion, offered her hand as he approached. "Lovely to meet you, Miss Sullivan." His voice was a thick rumble. He took her hand briefly and squeezed it. "I've heard a great deal about your family." "Oh." Emma couldn't understand why she was becoming flustered, and with a studied act of will, she managed to calm her pounding heart. "It's beautiful here," she said. Mr. Bell's chest swelled, as though he was solely responsible for the town's aesthetic qualities. "The people are wonderful, too, as you'll discover. Come inside, I'm sure you're both hungry and tired. Hannah has made coffee and spice cake. I'll help you with these, Alan. Lovely to see you, my boy." Horace picked up Emma's trunk and continued chatting to Alan as the two men mounted the porch steps. Emma followed a few paces behind, the darkened and empty windows of the town seeming to gaze at her from every direction, as if they had seen into her very soul and found it wanting. The inside of the house was dim, lit only by two gas lamps. When the group entered, a young woman looked up from her sewing. Emma knew this must be Hannah, Alan's twin sister, but she was immediately struck by how little they resembled one another. Whereas Alan was well-built, with angular features and intense dark eyes, Hannah was a wan, fragile creature, with dull blonde hair pulled severely back from a homely, asymmetrical face. Her eyes were a watery blue and ringed with red. Hannah did not rise from her chair and did not smile as Emma approached. She simply offered a limp hand in greeting. Emma took it, only to find the fingers hard and cold, like iron rods beneath a thin veneer of flesh. In the gaslight, the girl's pale eyes seemed to contain something fierce. "Nice to meet you, Hannah. Alan has told me so much about you." In fact, Alan had only mentioned her once or twice, and then vaguely, like something nearly forgotten, but Emma thought the girl might like the thought of her brother speaking lovingly of her. Hannah appeared to crave no such comfort. She nodded in acknowledgement of Emma's statements, then very deliberately lowered her head and went back to her sewing. Emma opened her mouth, perhaps to chastise the girl, but at that moment Mr. Bell came up behind her and touched her arm, gently guiding her to the far end of the room, where Alan was fussing with the trunks. "Don't judge her too harshly, miss," Mr. Bell whispered, inclining his head in the direction of his daughter. "She's never been right, if you catch my meaning. Besides, she's been keeping late nights these past weeks, working on the children's costumes for the festival." "Is that what she's sewing?" Emma glanced back at the shimmering white fabric in Hannah's lap with renewed interest. Horace chuckled. "They get to be ghosts and goblins once a year, and they insist on new and better costumes for every festival. Poor Hannah works her fingers to the bone, but it's all worth it when you see the finished products." He encircled both Emma and Alan with his powerful arms. "Now I'll take you to the shop and show you what I've been working on." He led them out through a door in the kitchen. Night had fallen, and except for the hard shining stars bangling the sky, the town was in darkness. Mr. Bell seemed to have no trouble navigating. His boots crunched on the path leading to the long looming structure behind the house. Emma pulled her shawl closer across her shoulders. The workshop was cavernous. Even after Mr. Bell lit the lamps, inky puddles of shadow pooled in every corner, and the ceiling was completely invisible. But in the feeble glow, it was readily apparent the space held a profusion of wonders. Emma gasped as she took in the scene. Everywhere was the gleam of exquisitely carved wood, a riot of shapes and movement, cherubs and stately angels, spiraling columns hugged by lifelike vines of ivy, foxes and rabbits and staring owls. The clock faces were works of art in their own right, smooth mother of pearl, glimmering with soft rainbow tones, bisected by iron hands, all of which stood dead still at 12. Why are they stopped? Emma was not willing to admit that the sight of so many silenced clocks made a chill scurry up her spine. I don't wind them until they've found a home, Mr. Bell said, his eyes twinkling. Here's my latest masterpiece. Emma approached it, Alan close behind. It was only about 2 feet tall, but made up for its small size and its intricacy of detail. The oval face, painted with tiny swirling leaves, was surrounded by a carved cascade of beautifully rendered apples, wheat stalks, grapes, and gourds. The fruits gleamed with an almost supernatural fire, and Emma felt a sudden desire to reach out and pluck one of the apples from the carving, fully expecting it to turn lush and crimson in her hand. She struggled for a word, though every one fell short of the mark. Mr. Bell seemed to understand. Thank you, my dear, he said. It's the culmination of the work I've done here, my tribute to Bounty Falls. Astonishing, said Emma finally, still finding the word inadequate, but glad to say something. Indeed, Father, you've outdone yourself. Alan took a step forward, his rugged features strangely shadowed in the gaslight. Emma and I passed the new factory on our way into town, he said, peering around the workshop. Emma feels that progress is coming for us all. Emma was about to protest, but when she saw the transformation in Horace Bell's face, she decided to keep silent. The old man's mouth pressed flat, and a vein throbbed in his high forehead. Progress, he said. Clocks and costumes. Machines making the two things that have always kept Hannah and I afloat. And making every clock, every garment, just like every other one. Soon everyone in town will have the same clock on his mantelpiece as everyone else has. And all the children will go to the festival with not even their parents being able to tell them apart. I ask you, miss, is that progress? Emma felt her cheeks growing hot. Mr. Bell, I surely didn't mean that the factory was a positive development, merely that it might be inevitable. Mr. Bell glared at her so fiercely that for a moment Emma feared her heart might freeze in her chest. Then the old man's expression softened. Inevitable, he repeated, his voice weary. On that you may be correct, miss. The individual who owns the factory is a scoundrel of my long acquaintance, and I know for certain it was built there specifically to destroy me. But perhaps, as you say, the days of craftsmanship are over. That would be a great shame, Emma said, partly to placate him, but partly because she meant it. Later that evening, Emma lay beneath the quilts in a narrow bed in an upstairs room. Since meeting Alan, she had usually spent her nights imagining what it would be like when they were married. When Alan would lie next to her, his warm breath tickling the back of her neck. It had always been a pleasant fantasy to fall asleep to, but tonight she was far too distracted. Her brain was a hive of questions and disturbing images of fire and dancing phantoms and shining clock faces. She thought these notions would keep her awake for hours to come, but before she was aware of it, exhaustion took over and she slept. Moonlight was streaming into the room when she woke again, bolting upright, clutching one of the quilts to her breast. That sound. For a moment, her racing mind couldn't place it, but then her knuckles tightened so hard on the fabric that the bone seemed poised to poke through the skin. Clocks. A monstrous symphony of ticking clocks, each keeping to its own pace in apparent indifference to the pace of the others, so the ticking was overlapping, disjointed, and horrible. Emma looked wildly around the room. Though she had no lamp, the pale white moon cast enough illumination to show that the small room lacked a single clock. Even if there had been, could a single clock make such a cacophony? Like the clacking of 1,000 devil's hooves. Emma crawled from the bed, pulling the quilt up around her ears to muffle the sound that seemed to be behind the walls and everywhere. She pushed aside the curtains and peered out the window. The workshop hunched there in the moonlight, still and silent. Emma had a vision of the clocks coming to life at once through some demonic agency, ticking away the moments until doomsday. She tried to chide herself for her folly, but found she could not. For surely midnight had passed, and wasn't it now the eve of All Saints' Day, when the veil between the living and the dead was at its most porous? Emma had never placed much stock in superstitions, but now, with the clock's hellish voices assaulting her from all directions, she found herself clapping her hands together and murmuring fervent prayers like a frightened child. The sound seemed to grow louder, and Emma tore from the window and dived for the bed, burying herself under the quilts, clamping her hands over her ears, curling herself into a tight ball and squeezing her eyes closed. In this way she lay, battered by the clamor, waiting and wishing for the swift onset of dawn. Another sound, a soft rapping, woke her again, though now the room was bright with autumn sunshine, and the alluring smells of coffee and griddle cakes permeated the air. The knocking was repeated and Emma sat up. "Are you up yet, darling?" said Alan. "I'm going down to breakfast." Emma, confused by her surroundings, unsure of the reality of the events in the night, managed to stammer, "Go on ahead, I'll be a few minutes." She heard his heavy tread descending the stairs. Had it all been a vivid dream? She tilted her head, listening, and thought she could hear, very faintly, a furtive ripple of ticking sounds. She strained to hear more, but the sound eluded her. Crossly, she threw aside the quilts, only to notice that the pattern decorating the fabric bore a disturbing resemblance to the interlocking gears of clockworks. Emma's skin went cold, and she leaped from the bed, pushing the covers violently away as though they were diseased. As she stood there, rubbing her arms to rid them of the quilt's tainted warmth, she knew she was being ridiculous. Hannah had likely made the quilts, after all, and as her father was a clockmaker, why wouldn't she use a clock motif in her handiwork? This explanation was perfectly reasonable, but Emma could not shake the visceral aversion she felt when she looked at the patterns. Nerves thrumming, she quickly dressed and made her way downstairs for breakfast. The sun was bright when Emma left the house. Breakfast had been an uncomfortable affair, with slope-faced Hannah peering suspiciously at her across the table, and Alan barely saying a word and fidgeting in his seat, periodically glancing out the windows with a crinkled brow. Only Horace seemed cheerful, eating his griddle cakes with great relish, talking endlessly about his clocks and the festival taking place that evening. Emma was only half listening. She thought she could still hear a distant ticking. Outside now, with Alan silently smoking a cigar in the straight-back chair next to her, Emma watched the townsfolk preparing for the festivities. It seemed surreal to see such a bustle after the desolation of the day before, and for a moment Emma got the feeling the people were not real at all, but simply painted cutouts being manipulated by some unseen force, strictly for her benefit. Emma shook herself. She usually took pride in the fact that she was a sensible woman and not prone to flights of fancy. But ever since arriving in Bounty Falls, she'd been entertaining ideas that distressed her by their proximity to lunacy. Even now, she was still hearing maddening hints of clocks ticking, coming from seemingly everywhere at once. Her head began to pound. Horace had retreated to his workshop to finish his latest clock that he planned to present to the town at the culmination of the festival. Hannah had vanished among the crowds, bearing armloads of multicolored fabrics, the last of the costumes she had made for the children. Everyone else in town seemed to be occupied in some way, arranging bundles of sticks in the square for the bonfire, hanging bunting, scrubbing windows and porch steps. The smell of roasting meat and baking pies saturated the crisp autumn air. Emma experienced these things distantly, as though she was reading about them rather than seeing them occurring in front of her. She had the persistent feeling the gaiety and industry on display was a veneer, a thin covering over something much darker seething beneath. To Emma, the odor of collective anxiety emanating from the busy townsfolk overrode the aromas of the feast being prepared. Suddenly cold, Emma snatched her gaze away from the scene. Alan, she noticed, was pointedly avoiding looking at it also. Cigar in mouth, he was staring fixedly down at his hands, as though he had never seen them before. Thinking it an unwise question, but nevertheless curious, Emma asked, "Why aren't you helping them?" She expected him to snap at her, but for a long moment he acted as though he hadn't heard. Emma was going to say something else, but then Alan turned his head and looked at her. His eyes were hollow and frightened. "I don't want any part of it," he said. And briefly it seemed to Emma that the faint ticking she'd been hearing grew perceptibly louder. It seemed he wanted to say more, but then his expression caved in further, as if he was struggling to remember something. Emma glanced out toward the town square again and swore she saw Hannah, still holding the now diminished pile of fabrics, staring hard at her from several hundred yards away. She tried to shake off the assertion. "What happens at the festival?" she asked, feeling the need to whisper even though the townspeople were too far away to hear. Alan looked away. "Nothing really. A feast, a bonfire. The children dance in their costumes. That's all." The sun went behind a cloud, and the temperature seemed to drop several degrees. Emma pulled her shawl across her shoulders. "Why don't you want any part of it, Alan?" She genuinely wanted to know, but when he opened his mouth to answer, she found herself wishing he would say nothing, or announce they were leaving Bounty Falls immediately. "I've forgotten," he said, scrubbing at his face with his hands. He looked pale and haggard. I always forget. With this mystifying reply, Alan seemed to have said everything he wished to say on the subject. He turned away from her, lit another cigar, and went back to scrutinizing his hand. Emma, seeing that the now empty-handed Hannah was heading purposefully back toward the house, excused herself and hurried back inside. Her headache was worsening, and her disturbed sleep of the night before was now catching up to her. She climbed the stairs to her room and locked the door behind her. Emma had not intended to sleep the entire day away, but when she woke, the light outside her window was low and orange, casting long shadows across the timepiece quilt that covered her. She could hear children laughing somewhere below, and the smells of food cooking and wood burning assaulted her nostrils. Her headache had subsided to a dull thud, but the phantom ticking seemed more prominent. Emma sat up, feeling sluggish and out of sorts. Rising from the bed, she smoothed her dress and hair and made her way downstairs. Alan was nowhere to be seen, but Horace was in the kitchen, transferring pies from cooling racks to trays, while Hannah knelt by the fire, making adjustments to a hooded cape worn by an angel-faced blonde child. "Be still, Miles," she said, and Emma was shocked into stillness by the sound of Hannah's voice, which had a deep droning resonance like the peal of a gong. It wasn't at all what Emma imagined a girl like Hannah would sound like. The child in the robe, whose face was painted green to match the fabric, beamed at Hannah. "My mama was going to get our costumes from that factory store this year," Miles said, "but I told her I wouldn't have one unless Miss Hannah made it. My brother said as much, too." Horace turned from his task, his oaken face a wreath of smiles. "That's a good boy, Miles. I'll save you an extra piece of Miss Hannah's apple pie. How's that?" Miles smacked his lips in a charmingly unselfconscious fashion, and Emma fancied she almost saw Hannah's mouth curling upwards, though it may have just been a trick of the light. Up until now, no one had seemed to notice Emma's presence on the stairs, but then Horace glanced up, his eyes sparkling with the knowledge that she'd been there all along. "I hope you had a nice rest, miss," he said. "I know how exhausting all this can be. If you're looking for Alan, I think he's in the workshop." It occurred to Emma that she might have offered to help the Bells with their festival preparations, but Horace's last pronouncement had the distinct flavor of a dismissal. So Emma nodded to him and Hannah in turn, then went through the back door out into the dusk. Light from the high windows of the workshop sliced down into the vast space, catching the curves of wooden angels' wings and rabbit haunches. When Emma entered, she couldn't see Alan at all, but after a moment her eyes adjusted, and she could just make out his rigid silhouette, his broad back facing her. He looked like one of his father's carvings, well-formed and motionless. Emma was transfixed by the sight of him. "My father wanted me to go into the trade, you know," Alan said suddenly, startling Emma as much as if one of the clocks had spoken. He turned his head so that the shafts of the setting sun fell upon his chiseled profile. "I always hated them, though, the clocks. Before I left Bounty Falls, I used to stand in here and wonder what it would be like to turn over a lamp and watch them burn to ashes." "Alan," she sputtered, wanting to move closer to him to reassure herself of his reality, but not daring. "How can you say such a thing? Your father's work is so beautiful." Alan turned fully toward her then, a thin smile ratcheting across the lower half of his face. "Yes," he said, "it is beautiful, isn't it?" He began moving toward her as though he was in a trance, a marionette pulled by strings. Emma's first instinct was to turn and run, but surely she was being ridiculous again. This was Alan Bell, who she'd known for 2 years, who would soon be her wedded husband. She would not run from him, no matter how peculiar he seemed. "Alan," she began. Just then, there was a shout from outside and a ragged cheer, followed by scattered laughter. Something flickered across Alan's shadowed face, then it passed, and he seemed quite himself again. His gaze focused past Emma, as if he could see through the workshop wall to the town square beyond. "The festival is starting," he said. Emma walked into the square with her hand gripping Alan's arm. The population of Bounty Falls had seemingly multiplied, for every porch and patch of grass and dusty roadway seethed with people. The sun had just slipped below the horizon, and torches had been lit around the perimeter of the square, sending waves of heat and warped yellow light into the encroaching darkness. Long tables, laden with food, formed a U around the man-high bundle of sticks that would serve as the bonfire. Most of the townsfolk had already begun celebrating, piling their plates with meat and steaming mounds of vegetables, drinking heavily from tankards of ale. Costumed children flitted through the crowds, trailing silk and ribbon like the fingers of phantoms, their faces tiny replicas of skulls, demons, and goblins. Everywhere was the sound of laughing and raucous conversation, broken up by the occasional mock shriek as one of the children sprang from beneath the table. The scene was utterly delightful, the aromas enticing, the sounds of gaiety inviting. Yet Emma's hold on Alan's arm tightened further as they approached. Even though she had eaten nothing since breakfast, Emma found she had no appetite and refused Alan's offer of a plate. Alan, for his part, appeared just as reluctant to partake and only nibbled at a piece of bread he plucked from one of the tables. He was still acting oddly, his face set like marble, but now it seemed he had resigned himself to whatever was going to occur. Emma's gaze darted through the crowd, settling on laughing faces, on the grotesque countenances of the disguised children. She thought that in the end there was no difference, that the children were simply manifesting the aspects of the adults that were usually kept well hidden. She shuddered and turned her head away from the spectacle, but there her eyes met those of Hannah, who was standing alone beneath a porch awning, arms folded across her chest. Emma quickly looked away and pressed farther into the crowd to escape the unsettling scrutiny. When she found herself at the edge of the bonfire site, a hush fell over the crowd, and for a moment all Emma could hear was the sharp crackle of the torches and that insistent, elusive ticking that had been dancing around the boundaries of her consciousness all day. Then the door to Horace Bell's shop opened, and the man himself emerged, clad in a smart black suit and bearing his marvelous harvest clock, its polished wood seeming to glow in the firelight. The townspeople gasped at the sight of it, and at an unseen signal, two men separated themselves from the assemblage and retrieved a large wooden pedestal that they had placed in the center of the gap made by the arrayed tables. Horace placed the clock reverently on the pedestal and then raised his eyes to the crowd. "This clock is dedicated to the essence of Bounty Falls," he said, "a God's proclamation spiraling into the night. I present it tonight at Harvest's End on the night when time becomes mutable, when all falsehood is stripped away to reveal the truth at the very core of ourselves. May it bring you continued comfort and prosperity as long as Bounty Falls endures." He gave a small bow, and then, amid the suspended silence, he produced a tiny silver key from the pocket of his coat and proceeded to wind the beautiful clock. The ticking, when it began, seemed as loud as the heavens. "Light the bonfire," Horace Bell shouted. Emma watched as though in a dream, the ticking penetrating to her very bones. The men in the crowd cleared away the banquet tables, leaving the enormous pile of sticks alone in the center of the square. Four children, resplendent in ghoulish finery, came forward, small torches clutched in their hands. They simultaneously thrust their torches into the pile, and then backed away to watch as the flames caught and spread, ejecting sparks that flew like meteors across the purple sky. The bonfire was still low, waiting for that critical moment when it would burst upward from its prison of sticks, tasting the air with its feelers of flame. But even in its modest glow, Emma began to see a change overtaking the townspeople. She still felt detached and unreal, and so was not particularly alarmed when she saw that the children nearest the fire no longer appeared to be children. Neither did they appear to be the goblins they masqueraded as. To Emma, their outer shells seemed to be dissipating, revealing what lay beneath, the gleaming springs and interlocking gears of elaborate clockworks, ticking in a maddening, inevitable way, just below the veneer of flesh and bone. Emma's gaze swept the crowd, and yes, she thought she could see everyone's true selves now, as the bonfire gained strength and brightness. Motors and springs and gears, marking the minutes inside each body, counting the time, controlling the motion. Emma's vision swam, and she could feel the heat of the rising fire tightening the skin of her face. "They're nothing but puppets, tin soldiers," she thought, and almost laughed. And then she glanced at Alan, and she did laugh, because behind his handsome and familiar face, he was ticking too, moving and thinking in time with the clicking gears. "Perhaps I'm nothing but clockwork myself," Emma thought, and considered looking down at her hands to check, but couldn't quite bring herself to do it. Instead, she fixed her attention on the wonderful clock, apt symbol of Bounty Falls. The light from the flames blazed around it, tracing a bright corona around the carved bounty on its living surface. Behind its mother-of-pearl face, Emma found herself peering into the vastness of space, moons and stars and planets ticking along their crystalline orbits, marking the passing of infinity. She could have easily become lost in the steady enormity of the clockwork universe, but she was torn from her trance by the sudden frenzy of the crowd, bodies jostling against her, and the sound of rapidly approaching carriage wheels. She struggled to see through the mob. The carriage was tall and black under the moonlight, pulled by two massive white horses. It clattered to a halt at the edge of the square, and then the driver leapt down and pulled open the door. Emma fought her way to a small gap in the crowd. She wasn't sure who she was expecting to emerge from the carriage, but the person who did absolutely stunned her. It was a woman, very tall and well-muscled. She was dressed in a peculiar garment that reminded Emma of the robes worn by ancient Romans, draped in marble white, accented with gold threads. The woman's hair was coppery red and fell loose around her proud face. The crowd, still tensely murmuring, backed away in one body as the extraordinary woman stepped forward into the firelight. Like the others, the bonfire seemed to have an effect on her, peeling away the outer layers of her being. But beneath her transparent shell, there lay no clockwork. There was only a sense of unbelievable antiquity, of mountains rising and crumbling, seas filling and receding, rocks forming in the crust of the earth. The fire suited her features, bringing her nature to the surface. Before she could speak, Horace Bell appeared at the front of the crowd. Emma realized she had yet to see him in the transforming glow of the bonfire. When she did, she was little surprised to see no clockwork behind his skin. For he was the clockmaker, was he not? His essence, Emma could see now, was one of unchanging time, a universe fixed upon its regular cycles, just as she had seen behind the face of the harvest clock that he had made. Emma's gaze found Alan, standing not far from the edge of the bonfire. She made her way back to him, still feeling dreamlike, but grasping for something familiar. Who is that woman? Alan looked at her as if he had never seen her before, the gears clicking behind his eyes. The factory. His voice was a monotone. Emma was going to ask what he meant, but then Horace's shrill voice pierced the air. Get away! He was standing so close to the woman that his breath fluttered her hair. I don't want you here. The woman smiled, and behind her eyes, comets fell and seeded the oceans with organisms that began splitting, multiplying. You can't keep me out forever, old man, she said, and then her gaze fixed quite suddenly on Emma, picking her out from the crowd with eerie precision. Progress will win out in the end, will it not, my dear? Emma's blood froze in her veins, and time itself seemed to pause. Then, in slow motion, dozens of clockwork faces turned toward her, the firelight casting devilish shadows. She shrank from them, knowing they perceived her as a colluder, a henchman of progress, when all they wanted was stability, order, and sameness. She tried to protest, but the fervid ticking of the town's infernal mechanics swallowed her voice. Even Alan seemed to have turned on her. Alan, who had forgotten why he left this town, forgotten what it was like to see what he really was. When she looked into his eyes, pleading silently for help, she saw nothing there but programmed rage, empty of reason. They pushed her until she could see only their transparent faces, blotting out the blackening sky. The fire was hot at her back, and she turned this way and that, fighting them with her hands. They pressed in, and she saw that the hem of her dress had caught, the flames dancing merrily around her feet. And then she screamed, but heard no sound. Desperately, she swung and clawed at the faces nearest her. By virtue of sheer hysteria, she broke and ran, tearing through the crowd like a flaming arrow, running as fast as her burning legs would carry her, running to no particular end, but just to get away, to escape from the clutching talons of the clockwork city. She thought she saw Hannah before her as she ran, and in Hannah's hard face she saw plainly the story of Bounty Falls, a spooling vision of a godlike old man and an experiment for a perfect, unchanging world. Emma had only a second to feel sorry for Hannah, for dear Alan, for all of them, living their regulated lives at the whim of their maker. Then the black shape of the workshop loomed, and she forced Hannah aside and fell, plunging forward, her legs finally giving out. In the moments before the flames consumed her, Emma saw her own hand in the truth-bearing light, and it comforted her to see the tiny atoms, splitting, changing, moving in unexpected ways. I am not like them, she thought, and she raised her eyes to take in the stately, dying universe shining behind every clock face in Mr. Bell's workshop. Then she lay back upon the shop's floorboards as the unpredictable flame swallowed her up and reached out for more. Death wore the seeming of a battered Chevrolet. The child's scream and the screech of rubber on concrete knifed through 2 seconds of time before snapping, like a celery stalk of sound, into aching silence. The silence of limbo, called into being for the space of a slow heartbeat. Then the thud of running feet, the rising hubbub of many voices. Give her air. Keep back. Don't try to move her. Somebody call an ambulance. Yeah, and somebody call a cop, too. I couldn't help it. It was the driver of the ramshackle Chevy. She fell off the curb right in front of me. Honest to God, it wasn't my fault. Gotta report these things right away, said the gray-haired man beside him. No cause to worry if you ain't to blame. Probably no brakes, said a heavily accented voice, and another spoke as if on cue. probably no insurance either. Let me through, oh please. The woman's voice was on the edge of hysteria. She came through the crowd like an automaton, not seeing the people she shoved and elbowed aside. DOA, said the woman heavily. Her face was no longer twisted with shock, and she was almost pretty again. DOA, dead on arrival, it means. Oh, Jim, I never knew they said that. Suddenly there were tears in her blue eyes. There had been many tears now. Take it easy, Jean, honey. Jim Blair hoisted his lank 6 feet out of the old rocker and crossed the room, running a nervous hand through his corn-shuck hair. She's only 30, he thought, and I'm 3 years older. That's awfully young to have bred 3 kids and lost them. He took her in his arms. I know how tough it is. It's bad enough for me and probably worse for you. But at least we're sure they'll never be bomb fodder, and we still have Joanna. She twisted away from him, her voice suddenly bitter. Don't give me that Pollyanna stuff, Jim. Goody-goody, only a broken leg. It might have been your back. There's no use trying to whitewash it. Our kids, our own kids, all gone. Dead. She began to sob. I wish I were, too. Jean. I don't care, I mean it. Everything bad has happened since Joanna came to live with us. Darling, you can't blame the child for a series of accidents. I know. She raised her tear-stained face. But after all, Michael drowned, then Steve falling off the water tower, now it's Marion. Her fingers gripped his arm tightly. Jim, each of them was playing alone with Joanna when it happened. Accidents, just accidents, he said. It wasn't like Jean, this talk. Almost... His mind shied away from the word and circled back. Almost paranoid. But Jean was stable, rational, always had been. Still, maybe a little chat with Dr. Holland would be a good idea. Breakdowns did happen. They both turned at the slamming of the screen door. Then came the patter of childish feet on the kitchen linoleum, and Joanna burst into the room. Mommy, I want to play with Marion. Why can't I play with Marion? Jean put her arm around the girl's thin shoulder. Darling, you won't be able to play with Marion for quite a while. You mustn't worry about it now. Mommy, she looked like she was just asleep. Then they came and took her away. Her lips trembled. I'm frightened, Mommy. Jim looked down at the dark eyes, misted now, the straight brown hair and the little snub nose with its dusting of freckles. She's all we have left, poor kid, and not even ours, really. Helen's baby. He looked up as the battered cuckoo clock on the mantel clicked warningly. Time for little girls to be in bed, Joanna. Run along now like a good girl and get washed. Even as he spoke, the miniature doors flew open and the caricature of a bird popped out, shrilly announcing the hour. It cuckooed 8 times, then bounced back inside. Joanna watched, entranced. Bedtime, darling, said Jean gently. School tomorrow, remember? And don't forget to brush your teeth. I won't. Good night, Mommy. Good night, Daddy. She turned up her face to be kissed, smiled at them, and was gone. They listened to her footsteps on the stairs. Jim, I'm sorry about the things I said. Jean's voice was hesitant, a little ashamed. It is hard, though. You know it is. Jim, aren't you listening? After all, you don't have to watch the clock now. Her smile was as labored as the joke. He smiled back. I think I'll take a walk, honey. Some fresh air would do me good. Jim, don't go. I'd rather not be alone just now. Well, he looked at her, keeping his expression blank. All right, dear. How about some coffee? I could stand another cup. And he thought, tomorrow I'll go. I'll talk to Holland tomorrow. Let me get this straight, Jim. Holland's pudgy face was sober, his eyes serious. You started out by thinking Jean was showing paranoid tendencies, and offhand, I'm inclined to agree with you. Overnight, you changed your mind and began thinking that maybe, just maybe, she might be right. Honestly, don't you suspect your own reasons for such a quick switch? Sure I do, Bob, Blair said worriedly. Do you think I haven't beaten out my brains over it? I know the idea is monstrous, but just suppose there was a branch of humanity, if you could call it human, living off us unsuspected. A branch that knows how to eliminate competition, almost by instinct. Now hold on a minute, Jim. You've taken Jean's reaction to this last death, plus a random association with a cuckoo clock, and here you are with a perfectly wild hypothesis. You've always been rational and analytical, old man. Surely you can realize that a perfectly normal urge to rationalize Jean's conclusions is making you concur with them against your better judgment. Bob, I'm not through, Jim. Just consider how fantastic the whole idea is. Because of a series of accidents, you can't accuse a child of planned murder. Nor can you further hypothesize that all orphans are changelings imbued with an instinct to polish off their foster siblings. Not all orphans, Bob. Not planned murder either. Take it easy. Just some of them. A few of them. Different. Growing up, placing their young with well-to-do families somehow, and then dropping unobtrusively out of the picture. And the young growing up and always the natural children dying off in one way or another. The changeling inherits and the process is repeated step by step. Can you say it's impossible? Do you know it's impossible? I wouldn't say impossible, Jim, but I would say that your thesis has a remarkably low index of probability. Why don't others suspect besides you? Jim spread his hands hopelessly. I don't know, maybe they do. Maybe these creatures, if they do exist, have some means of protection we don't know about. You need more than maybes, Jim. What about Joanna Simmons' mother? According to your theory, she should have been well off, was she? No, she wasn't, Jim admitted reluctantly. She came here and took a job with my outfit. Said she was divorced and had lived in New York. Then she quit to take a position in California, and we agreed to board Joanna until she got settled. Warrenburg was the town. She was killed there, quite horribly, in a terrible auto accident. Have you any reason for suspecting skullduggery? Honestly, Jim, or for labeling her one of your human, cuckoos? Only my hunch. We had a newspaper clipping and a letter from the coroner. We even sent the money for her funeral. But those things could be faked, Bob. Give me some evidence that they were faked, and I'll be happy to reinspect your views. Holland got up out of his chair. In the meantime, relax. Take a trip if you can. Try not to worry. Jim grinned humorlessly. Mustn't let myself get excited, eh? Okay, Bob. But if I get hold of any evidence that I think you might accept, I'll be back. Last laugh and all that. Pending developments, you take it easy, too. Don't let yourself get overworked. Stay out of the sun. So long now. So long, Jim. It was cool in the Warrenburg City Hall, though outside the streets were sizzling. Sorry, Mr. Blair, said the stout, motherly woman with the horn-rimmed glasses. We've no record of Helen Simmons. Nothing whatever. She closed the file with resolute finality. Jim stared at her. Are you sure? There must be something. Mightn't there be a special file for accident cases? She was here in Warrenburg. She died here. The woman thinned her lips and shook her head. If we had any information, it'd be right where I looked. There isn't a thing. Have you tried her last address? Maybe they could tell you something. We can't. I'll try that next. Thanks a lot. Sorry we couldn't help you. He went out slowly. 872 Maple was a rambling frame house dozing on a wide flower-bordered lot. There was nothing sleepy about the diminutive woman who opened the door to Jim's knock. Snapping black eyes peered at him from a maze of wrinkles. A veined hand moved swiftly to smooth down the white hair that framed her face. Looking for someone, young man? Just information, Mrs. Collins, and it's Miss. Don't give out information about guests. You a bill collector? No, Miss Collins. As a matter of fact, I'm trying to check up on an old friend I lost track of. Helen Simmons. She lived at this address for a while. Sure did. Well, come on in. Mind you, I don't usually do this, Mr. Blair. Without any fanfare, a bill changed hands. Mr. Blair, well, I can't tell you much. Try that green chair for size. What do you want to know? Jim studied the toe of his right shoe. His eyes were veiled. I heard she was hurt and hard up, and I was worried. My wife and I were friends of hers back east. Hurt? Hard up? Not likely. Spending all her time driving that English car around, taking trips. I'm not saying she didn't mind her manners, though. Did she have any close friends? She was chummy with Edith Walton, that girl that works for Doc Mendel. He's county coroner in his spare time. No men, didn't fool around at all. I'd have known. Behind Jim's stony eyes, the pattern took clearer form, as if a mosaic approached completion. A mosaic of carefully planned events that totaled horror. He shivered as the outlines of his hunch filled in. Helen, what creatures were these? Helen, not dead, not poor, carefully planting ostensible proof of her death and going on to a new role, a new life, in London or Paris or Rome. A free, untrammeled life. And her child, if child was the word, in his home repeating the pattern. Eliminating competition as her mother undoubtedly had done. The competition, his and Jean's children, changeling. No, not that. Incubus. He shivered again. Rabbits on your grave, Mr. Blair? He looked up slowly. Sorry, I was just wondering. Did Miss Simmons have a job while she was here? No, she didn't. One thing she did do was rent a place. Used to be Bland's Hardware. Paid a month's rent, too. Said some friends of hers were planning to open a mortuary. Seemed like a funny way for people to do business, but then no affair of mine. Funny? No, not funny at all, but icily, eerily logical. There had to be an undertaking parlor where he could send the funeral expenses. He wondered if Helen had laughed when she opened the letter. Everyone his or her own undertaker, and the carefully cultivated friend in the coroner's office, for stationery. He got to his feet. "Thanks a lot, Miss Collins. You've been a great deal of help." He almost smiled as he asked, "I don't suppose she left a forwarding address?" The old head shook decisively. "Not a thing. Just packed and left one Monday morning." All the loose ends tied up tight on a Monday morning. Nothing to cause suspicion. Nothing to worry about. Only a woman's almost paranoid hysteria and a glance at a clock. Not very much to unmask. Incubus. And what could he do? What could he do? Start talking and land in an institution. Well, there was one thing. "Thanks again, Miss Collins." He went out. Swanson didn't look like the general conception of a small-town newspaper man. One knew instinctively that his beard wouldn't have been tobacco-stained, even if he'd cared to grow one. And he didn't have a bottle of bourbon in the file marked miscellaneous, or if he did, he didn't bring it out. "That never came from my paper," he said precisely. He handed the clipping back to Jim. "We don't use that type, for one thing. For another, Miss Simmons, so far as I know, wasn't killed here or anywhere else." "You knew her?" "I knew of her. I never met her." "What about this report of her death?" Swanson shrugged, tented manicured fingers. "It's a hoax. Any job printing shop with a linotype could do it. In all likelihood, it was someplace in San Francisco. That's closest. It would be very difficult to check." His curiosity was showing. "I see. Well, thanks for your time and trouble, Mr. Swanson." "Not at all. Sorry I couldn't be of more help." "One thing to do. One thing that must be done. Motors over the mountains, and riding with them the numb resolve. Motors over the salt pans, the wheatlands, the corn belt." The stewardess stops again. "Coffee, sir? A sandwich, perhaps?" "I beg your..." "Oh, no, no thanks." She watches him covertly, uneasily, longing for the end of the run. Motors in the night. And the dull determination growing, strengthening. The airport, baggage, the ancient taxi with the piston slap, and at last the dark, familiar street. "Jim, you're back. Oh, Jim, darling, next time they send you west, I'm going too, I am." "Okay, Jean, sure, why not?" "What's the matter, dear? Oh, you're tired, of course, I should have known. Sit down, Jim, let me get you a drink." "In a minute, Jean. Do it now, now, now." "Where's Joanna?" "She's in bed, hours ago. Jim has something..." "Nothing, dear, I just want to look in on her, and freshen up a bit, of course." "Jim..." He smoothed away the worried frown with his forefinger. "In a minute, dear." She smiled uncertainly. "Hurry back, Jim." The stairs unwind irrevocably, slow motion and a nightmare. The bedroom door opens, the hall light dim on the bed and the child's face, incubus in the half-dark. For a moment, Jim remembered wondering somewhere, sometime, what strange powers of protection might be implicit in such a creature. As the thought came into his mind, Joanna stirred. She opened her eyes and looked at him. He took one step toward the bed. The little girl eyes over their dusting of freckles slitted. Then they opened wide, became two glowing golden lakes that grew and grew. There was the feeling of a great soundless explosion in his mind, waves of cool burning in his brain, churning and bubbling in every unknown corner, every cranny. Here and there a cell or a group of cells blanked out, the complex molecules reverting, becoming new again, ready for fresh punch marks. Synapses shorted with soundless cold fire and waited in timeless stasis for rechanneling. The waves frothed, became ripples, were gone. He stood unmoving. What was it he was supposed to do? Let's see. Tuck Joanna's blanket around her. But she was covered up, snugly. Sleeping soundly, too, and for a few seconds he'd thought she was awake. And Jean was waiting downstairs. Jean and a cool drink. Oh yes, stop in the bathroom. The stairs wind up again. It's good to be with one's family, relaxed in the well-known chair. Not a worry in the world. He sat there, his mind at ease, not caring much about anything. He didn't even look up when the clock on the mantel whirred, and the ridiculous bird popped out of its nest to herald a new day.